Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, March 12, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the Heckler's Veto, sponsored by our Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group. We apologize for the delay. But we're ready to get started now. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome three expert speakers. Our first speaker that we're going to hear from is Nina Shea, and she is a senior fellow and director at the Center for Religious Freedom at the Hudson Institute. And then we're going to have Dr. Zudi Jasser, who is the founder and president of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. And then our third expert, who should be well known to a lot of you, is Professor Eugene Volokh, who is the Gary T. Schwartz Professor of Law at the UCLA School of Law. So we're going to hear from Nina Shea first. Each of our speakers is going to take 5 to 10 minutes for an opening statement to talk about their views. On this topic, and then we'll have time after that for your questions. So, Nina Shea, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much. It's very timely conversation, actually, since the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, and then we later saw attacks in Scandinavia against cartoonists of the Islamic Prophet. And this is part of a trend that we have been seeing really since 1989 in the West, when Iran called for, issued a fatwa, Ayatollah Khomeini issued a fatwa against the author, the British author Salman Rushdie, against his book Satanic Verses. And in the fatwa, it said that anyone connected with it should be killed. And it was the responsibility of all Muslims to eradicate these people connected with the book. And in fact, the Japanese translator was murdered, and various translators were attacked and wounded. A hotel in Turkey was blown up where the publishers were meeting. There were bookstores, two bookstores in California that were firebombed at the time. The Organization for Islamic Cooperation, which is an international body of about 56 member states, have a charter that says that their purpose, their mandate, is to defend Islam. And at that time, after that time, they began campaigning internationally for an international criminal law to stop the defamation of Islam. And it was introduced into the UN year after year and passed year after year. The language was changed to defamation of religions, so it wasn't just singling out Islam, but that's who was really the lobby behind it. And it was gaining momentum. It took on particular salience after, in around the 2005, 2006, we started seeing the Danish cartoon crisis. These were the cartoon contest that was held in a Danish paper, very obscure paper by world standards, to draw the Islamic prophet Muhammad. And those triggered riots throughout the world, throughout the Muslim world, burning of the Danish embassy, boycotts against Danish products, and so forth. Then the Pope's speech at Regensburg, when Pope Benedict was actually quoting from a medieval pope and saying something that was perceived as negative to Islam, and that also created riots in the streets of Europe. And then the Theo van Gogh, who was making a film about women under Islam with Ayan Hirsi Ali, the Somalian parliamentarian who in the Netherlands, and he was stabbed to death in the streets of Amsterdam as he was riding his bicycle by a fanatic who said that he had defiled the Quran by his documentary. So these acts of violence were independent of, but working with the OIC to give this a gravity that this an international human right for religions not to be defamed was justified and was accepted by the majority of the world's countries. Now, what defamation of Islam meant was never defined. And, you know, some of us think of it in the West as, well, you know, the cartoons is sort of the iconic example that the prophet can't be ridiculed, or that the Quran can't be desecrated. In fact, even Pope Francis recently said something about the fact that there's no right to insult religion. But the problem is that this is a very subjective and very elastic standard of what it is to defame religion and defame Islam in particular. And Pakistan, which led the campaign in the UN, you know, of course, has one of the world's strictest black letter laws against blasphemy, Islamic blasphemy, which defamation of religion is another word for. Hate speech, religious hate speech, is also another way that it's often referred to. Pakistan has people on death row, including Christian mother of five, Asia Bibi, for defaming the prophet. What was said or done, we don't know, because to even repeat that in the court would be an act of defamation of Islam. The Ahmadiyyas, a sect within Islam, are considered heretical. They're blasphemy laws, two blasphemy laws on the books in Pakistan just against the Ahmadiyyas for existing. Saudi Arabia is a current case of Badawi, the blogger, who received a sentence of 1,000 lashes and 10 years in prison for blogging about reforming Saudi Arabia. It's considered defamation of Islam because Saudi Arabia itself is an Islamic state. The cases go on. American Bangladeshi recently hacked to death in a book fair in Bangladesh. Iraq, we saw ISIS, the Islamic State, going after the ancient artifacts of Nimrod with sledgehammers and drills because that was an insult to Islam, their very existence. Sufi manuscripts destroyed in Mali by a radical group. And Iran, of course, which started this, bringing these standards to this demand to the West, considers many things blasphemous, but among them are Baha'is. The very existence of the Baha'i religion is considered an insult to Islam because it came after Islam, and they have no rights, not even a right to live, if they can be killed with impunity in Iran. So this continued for about 10 years in the UN, and then some countries started becoming aware, and there was an active attempt during the Bush administration to end the support for this really anti-liberal, anti-free speech movement that was very protean, that could be applied to all sorts of things. And the way it would work is if your country did not punish people who defamed Islam, then that country would be considered a human rights violator. And those countries that do impose 1,000 lashes for some criticism would be considered countries that uphold, states that uphold human rights. So it really turned the human rights system on its head, and not to mention the entire constitutional system here in the United States and the whole liberal tradition. The Obama administration came in and decided that that a strategy for ending this was to have a resolution that would call for those countries with hate speech laws to implement them more consistently. And To me, that was fine. Let's just end it there. We don't have hate speech laws in the United States, and it didn't require that, this resolution. But for some reason, Secretary of State at that time, Hillary Clinton, decided that we should have a follow-up outside the UN, and that the United States should lead this in partnership with the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the OIC, developing standards a conversation, a world conversation about how to implement this resolution. So this was outside of the UN, sort of a transnational process. The first meeting was in Istanbul, so it was called the Istanbul Process. The next meeting a year later, I happened to go to, because I was on an independent government commission that allowed me entree into this meeting. And it was really astonishing to me because it consisted of Pakistan's ambassador and Saudi's ambassador and the various Islamic cooperation in the OIC states, all sitting in a round table with our civil rights assistant attorney general, speaking about how the United States handled bigotry. And it went through all the examples of bigotry in the United States, and saying that the United States government was prosecuting these and showing how we were prosecuting. So there was absolutely he did not present any theory about freedom of expression or defend the United States' freedom of expression or robustly at all. In fact, he didn't talk about it. He didn't really fail to explain the pluralism and extraordinary acceptance of minorities and minority religions in the United States. Instead, it really fed this narrative that the United States was a very bigoted country. That was my view. The next thing that got me very concerned was that the Benghazi incident occurred, and the attack and murder of the American ambassador and his guards, his security detail, and the administration blamed a film done by a copt emigre to the United States in California for this film that insulted the Islamic prophet. And the victims' families were told that by the U.S. That don't worry, I heard this secondhand, so it may not be true, but I think it was. I have no reason not to believe it, that don't worry, we're going to get the guy who did this film. And sure enough, it really astonished me. There was an investigation by the FBI ordered by the United States to look at the filmmaker, and they found something on him, a parole violation, and he was imprisoned, and he was sentenced to a year in prison. And really, it was a demonstration, I think, of the administration to our partners in the OIC now that we do punish defamation of Islam. So I think it was extremely dangerous. Now, we still have robust First Amendment protections in the United States, and we saw that just this week with a federal court case deciding that Philadelphia transit system had to display an ad, even though it was the city of Philadelphia banned it because, quote, it was inflammatorily anti-Muslim speech. So we do have that, but I do worry that our freedoms are very susceptible to erosion, that are very vulnerable, because various civic institutions in the United States are implementing this standard on its own. And again, it's really to protect Islam against defamation, and it's very inconsistent with the way they treat, say, Catholicism or Judaism or Mormonism or, you know, other religions. And, you know, I'm thinking of the Yale University Press that in its touted as a definitive expose on the Danish cartoon crisis by a Danish professor named Jette Clausen, owned the copyright to the newspaper page that carried the Danish cartoons. The author wanted it in the book, and the Yale University Press decided no, that could had to be censored out, that had to come out of the manuscript. And the John Negroponte, who was one of the advisors to the Yale University Press, said that it was because he feared violence in the Muslim world, a violent reaction in the Muslim world. And that's on record. So again, here's this example of the heckler's veto at work. And there are many other examples in the media, universities, and the universities are particularly egregious at this, in fact, in trying to regulate speech on behalf of certain groups, but not others, groups that are very vocal. And in fact, I was part of a discussion earlier this in September, in my own alma mater, Smith College. After Smith College decided to intimidate away, basically, the student body intimidated away its commencement speaker, Christine Lagarde of the IMF, the president of Smith decided this had gone too far and there was a silent majority and their views should be at the table as well. And so she held a conversation in New York called made a conversation about free speech, basically, and it was called the Getting Beyond the Ideological Echo Chamber. And I was asked to speak on the panel. Well, the panel went fine, but the transcript, I was stunned to find out, had trigger warnings and labels of bigotry against about almost everything that anyone said at that discussion, including my own statement, which was labeled Islamophobic, because I had said that I was concerned that one of these entities that self-censor was the State Department who had banned the terms caliphate and jihadist and Islamist. And I said, I made the point, how can we even understand what is happening in Iraq today with the Islamic State if we can't mention these words? That was bracketed and labeled as Islamophobic speech because I pointed out that fact. I'll just leave it at that and say that the American First Amendment free speech is alive, it's kicking, but I think we have to be very, very much on our guard. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is Christian Corrigan again. I think next, if we've got him on the line, we'll hear from Dr. Zudi Jasser, who is the founder and president of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. Dr. Jasser, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Fantastic. Well, the floor is yours now.
Okay, thank you. And I want to thank the Federalist Society for doing this. I can't tell you how important this issue is to us. And at the American Islamic Forum, what I want to do is sort of ratchet it back a bit and give you sort of the 70,000-foot view about why this is important. And I know a lot of your work often focuses on domestic issues, and I can't tell you how important America is in this national security issue and global issue regarding free speech, and that free speech is basically the tip of the spear of the battle, if you will, of the 21st century against the radicalization process of radical Islam, and that ultimately the heckler's veto, if you will, there's sort of a synergistic cooperation between the hecklers of these societies and the governments, or the OIC, as Nina laid out, this 56-country cabal of dictators, autocrats, and monarchs who will exploit our preference for protecting or respecting religions in order to prevent any type of reform or what they would perceive as heresy. And I think ultimately it's really important because at the core, their complaints about free speech and their complaints about the harm which criticism of Islam does is an attempt to preserve the Islamic State. So this is why our organization is dedicated to the separation of mosque and state, because as long as the Islamic State has oxygen, they will always be able to link free speech to sedition, to treason. So ultimately, if you counter, and within their countries, people who try to exert free speech are put in jail. They are the, you know, as Natan Sharansky's piece in the Washington Post a month or two ago talked about, is that this is a new Cold War, and the prisoners of conscience have been ignored. So Raif Badawi, who ran an organization called Free Saudi Liberals, which is basically very similar to ours, and if our organization was in Saudi Arabia, I would be in prison, and this man is being flogged or was being flogged in front of a mosque because he, quote-unquote, criticized Islam. And ultimately, he criticized the clerics, he criticized the governmental interpretation of Islam, but this is a devout Muslim who loved his faith. So the bottom line is they use criticism of Islam and their complaints of it as a mechanism to obstruct reform and maintain 13th century interpretations of Islam. So when people say, where are the moderate voices of Islam, free speech and the restriction of that is the very reason why you don't hear those voices. And the other issue has to do with sort of the other front of this battle, which is the obstruction of this debate in America. Because at its core, this debate is a very American debate. While we may say that this is a problem within Islam, let the Muslims sort of duke it out, you know, in their process to come to terms with modernity, America has gone through this. Our revolution was based on a battle against theocracy. And if there's anyone in the world that should understand the ability to take sides within a battle against theocracy, I would think it would be America. And yet most of, especially left of center in the United States, there's a political correctness, if you will, which is actually a deference to the Islamist autocrats and dictators to say that only they can determine what is and what is not Islam. And then, you know, things like donations from the Qatar Foundation or tens of millions by the Saudis, what it does is it buys them silence into foundations like the Clinton Foundation and others and universities that prevent a debate about Islam. And thus you'll find in exchange for that investment, you don't see any reform-minded voices that are trying to defeat the Islamic State concept. So what they say is that the militants are their enemy, and they give great speeches about how the king of Saudi Arabia or Qatar or even the president of Egypt is against radical Islam and against Al-Qaeda, and yet they still get their inspiration as oligarchs who run the Islamic State, and people who criticize them then are not only criticizing the president but criticizing Islam. So the two are very wedded, and if we're going to get to a solution, if you want to drain the pool of the ideology that creates these radicals, the continuum of radicalization starts at the sort of the Rubicon of free speech. And ultimately, until we begin to say that the Islamic State is a theocracy that prevents criticism and reform, that is, I think, a very American argument that we need to make, and I think all of you are experts in that. And it's all about Islamo-patriotism. One of the amazing things is as you look at blasphemy laws and criticism of the Prophet, if they really took this as a theological argument, in Islam, criticism of God is much more important. Criticism of Jesus, of Moses, of Abraham, all the prophets are of equal theological importance. Mustafa Akil wrote an op-ed in the New York Times 2 months ago in which he said, as is after the Charlie Hebdo assassinations, he said, the reason Muhammad takes on such an important iconization is not because of his primary theological role, but because it's the only prophet that Muslims have alone and don't share with any other faith. So therefore, it's exploited by Islamo-nationalism or Islamo-patriotism to unify them in a movement against the West, against the Zionist conspiracies, Western conspiracies, whatever other demonization they want to do, and thus prevent the reforms that need to be made. And ultimately, that is, if you look at the prisoners of conscience in Iran and Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, it is done in order to prevent reform. And I think they exploit the fact that they assume the West is ignorant about Islam and does not want to get into this battle within Islam and take sides for liberty against theocracy. And ultimately, what's happening in the West is the racialization of Islam. Islam is an ideology. It's not a race. And yet, if you criticize Islamism, which is the Islamic State concept that the government should be based in an Islamic identity and its laws then are derived from Sharia and not from reason, and thus are exegetical derivations rather than reason-based derivations, that ultimately that is a if the West gets into that, then they're offending Muslims, and that's why our focus is on countering violent extremism. It's not on countering violent Islamism, because if we got into the debate about Islamism and the Islamic State, the natural next step would be to lift up reformers who need platforms to combat theocracy. And yet all of our largest agencies in government right now are focused on countering a tactic. So it's amazing that in the Cold War we were countering communism, in the World War II we were countering fascism, and now we seem to be countering a tactic instead of the ideology that threatens us. And free speech, sort of the heckler's veto, is a tool by these governments, these theocracies in various shades. I mean, Pakistan portrays itself as a secular government, but yet that secular military rule bases its oligarchical control on an Islamic identity. The Saudi royal family is a oligarchy that says that they have the keys to the kingdom and are the custodians of the mosque, and anyone that disagrees with them must not know Islam. So the only difference between the Saudi government or the Pakistani government and ISIS is the Brotherhood out of Egypt or ISIS are sort of populist Islamo-fascist movements or Islamo-patriotic movements, and the royalties or the secular governments that are Islamic are oligarchical movements. And yet they both feed from the same trough, which is to prevent criticism or modernization of Islam. So the reformists who are trying to get voices, whether it be in the Green Revolution or in the revolutions in Egypt, can't get a voice if the West doesn't listen to them. And what I wanted to end on is to tell you, if you look in Egypt, 60 years of Nasser Mubarak and Nasser Sadat and Mubarak fueled, actually, the Brotherhood movement, while yet 1 year of an open society of the Brotherhood running government did more to destroy the infrastructure of the ideas of the Muslim Brotherhood, because you had an open debate in society where they were being criticized. You had open, much more open media, etc. Now, they were much worse than Mubarak, and the population went to the streets, and in 10 million, almost five times more than went to the streets against Mubarak. But yet I think you prove that an opening, free speech can be so much more of a tool to deconstruct Islamist theocratic ideas than 60 years of a more so-called benevolent, or however you want to describe it, dictatorships that actually are part of the problem. So we need a strategy, and I think a strategy to defeat the jihad is countering Islamism at its core, and free speech can only be defended. And if the heretics or the reformists like ourselves and Raif Bedawi and others can only be defended if we in the West provide that narrative that it's about freedom versus theocracy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jasser. All right. Well, now for the domestic perspective, I'm going to turn it over to Professor Eugene Volokh from UCLA Law School. So go ahead, Professor Volokh.
Hi. Thanks very much for having me on the call. So in America, you're free to criticize, generally speaking, any religion, any ideology, and the First Amendment protects that. On balance, it's been doing a pretty good job of protecting that. But there are some dangers that I want to outline, and they fall into two main categories. One is the logic of so-called harassment laws, and the second is the logic of fear. So the first relates to restrictions on speech that supposedly creates a hostile environment based on religion or race or ethnicity or what have you. These emerged first when it comes to workplace, so there's hostile work environment harassment law, but they've also been used, this logic has been used as a justification for campus speech codes, and in fact for times the federal government pressuring universities to impose certain campus speech codes, though at times the federal government has denied it was doing that. It's also been used in some situations in the public accommodations context, where the theory is that places that are open to the public have a duty to prevent offensive speech that may create a hostile environment for some of their patrons. Now, in some situations, in many situations, these laws actually don't pose any problem, partly because they also apply to physical conduct. Classic sexual harassment might be either sexual extortion, not exactly hostile environment harassment, but related, or it could be unwanted sexual touching and the like. And in other situations, it's things like threats and other kinds of unprotected speech. But in quite a few cases, the logic of these rules has been used to restrict political and ideological advocacy that is perceived as racist or religiously biased or what have you. We see that quite prominently, although in a kind of a very juvenile context, in the events this week at the University of Oklahoma, where two students were expelled for saying racist things, not even to black students, but in a place where they thought they were just talking amongst each other. But that it was recorded and then passed along, and then eventually people learned about them. The rationale of the university president was indeed that this speech created a hostile environment. And so the theory basically is, if you say anything that might reveal that you are a racist or by extension religiously bigoted or whatever else, maybe anti-gay, then your very presence on campus, even if all your speech is off campus, your very presence on campus creates a hostile environment for people of certain groups, and therefore you ought to be expelled. As a practical matter, I can certainly see I would be very offended if there were, say, anti-Semites. I'm Jewish. If there were anti-Semites sitting next to me in class, but I don't see that as a permissible basis for expelling students. Unfortunately, quite a few universities and government actors, other government actors, seem to think that that's fine. And what can be done with regard to allegedly racist speech or actually racist speech in the Oklahoma case can be done with regard to anti-religious speech. There's one prominent example of this in the employment context. This is a lawsuit brought against Bruce Teft, who was a counterterrorism advisor hired by the NYPD. And he had a habit of sending department-wide emails that were harshly critical of Muslims, Islam, and apparently Arabs. This was in the years following the 9/11 attacks. So he'd say things like, a good Muslim can't be a good American, or without Islam there wouldn't be any Islamic terror, or burning the hate-filled Quran, I'm quoting here, should be viewed as a public service at the least. Now, he may very well have been an ineffective employee for the New York Police Department. May have been wise for the NYPD not to hire him as an advisor, because first of all, I think some of the things he says, like a good Muslim can't be a good American, I think are quite wrong. But beyond that, I think they're counterproductive, given that the NYPD has to be able to work effectively with Muslim New Yorkers, among other things, to help foil terrorist plots. Nonetheless, the claim wasn't just that the NYPD could fire him. It's that it had to fire him, and the fact that it did not, the fact that it allowed him to say such things, made the NYPD and Teft himself legally liable creating a religiously hostile environment for Muslim or Arab American. By the way, all the speech was almost entirely about Muslims. Very, very little was about Arabs. But making Muslim police officers feel uncomfortable and feel offended. And of course, since the harassment laws don't just apply to police departments, they apply to any employer. This means that if a think tank wanted to if a think tank employee sent out such messages, or a newspaper employee, or a law firm employee, or anybody else harshly criticizing Islam and Muslims, that speech would be legally actionable. And in fact, the federal district judge allowed the case to go forward. As I understand it, it's been settled, as often happens in these cases, when a judge allows it to go forward. So I think that's unconstitutional, even on its own. But one extra problem is that whatever you may think of workplace harassment law, it's been leaking into the university context, even though pretty much every court decision, and there have been quite a few in lower courts, that has considered a campus speech code or a campus harassing speech code, has struck it down. Nonetheless, despite that pattern, we see case after case in which universities try to restrict anti-Muslim speech, and including allegedly blasphemous speech. So one example was, following the original publication of the Muhammad cartoons, a professor at Century College in Minnesota posted the cartoons on the bulletin board because they were very much in the news. The university censored that, and they actually ordered her to put a curtain and a warning sign over the cartoons. Again, this wasn't even harsh criticism of Islam on her part. This was her displaying cartoons that were in the news. The same thing happened to students at the University of Chicago and at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. New York University, when it hosted a panel discussion on the cartoons, refused to allow the cartoons to even be displayed, although I'll get to that a little bit more in the context of not the harassment problem, but the fear problem. Likewise, at San Francisco State University, there was a College Republicans group that at one of their events had a kind of a paper version of the Hamas flag, and they trampled on it to demonstrate their contempt for Hamas, contempt I very much share. Turns out the Hamas flag has, apparently has, the name of Allah written on it. Muslim groups complained, saying this is harassing to them as Muslims because it creates a religiously hostile environment to see this blasphemy. And the university, for quite a while, investigated the students. Eventually, charges were dropped against them, and a federal district court struck down the campus speech code as a First Amendment violation. So I think there's a very serious problem here, stemming from this notion that that speech that creates a hostile environment can be and indeed must be restricted, whether in workplaces or educational institutions or restaurants or bars or elsewhere. And that's kind of bringing in through the back door the kind of hate speech restrictions that have been quite firmly rejected by courts when framed in hate speech terms. The second problem, of course, is the problem that some institutions are restricting the speech not because they are afraid it will offend their employees or patrons, but because they're afraid it will lead to violent reaction. So that's what happened in the NYU panel discussion. That's what happened with Yale University when it refused to print the cartoons, as Nina pointed out, in a book about the cartoons controversy. Which is kind of almost an intentional self-parody. Now, I should say, I sympathize with institutions, and there are also private institutions which are not directly bound by the First Amendment. I sympathize with institutions that are just thinking, look, we don't want there to be violence generally triggered by what we say, but also particularly we don't want violence against our employees and our students and our patrons. We have a duty to them to try to protect them. I think those are serious concerns. But what they miss is the basic rule of psychology, which is behavior that is rewarded is repeated. If thugs learn that once they threaten violence, people will just not say the things that the thugs don't want them to say, that once they threaten violence and act violently towards people who post Muhammad cartoons, people will no longer post Muhammad cartoons. And of course, once thugs learn that, they're going to learn the next step, which is, oh, well, why don't we threaten violence against anyone who criticizes Islam more generally? And of course, other groups can pick up the message too. Why not threaten violence against anyone who criticizes Russia or criticizes North Korea, as we saw with the Sony hack situation, or criticizes Iran? So as a result, while I sympathize with the position of places like Yale and NYU that want to prevent violent reprisals, I think ultimately they're damaging the freedom of academic debate that is vital for those very institutions to survive. So I think they have to act not driven by their fear. They should certainly put up extra security protection and the like in order to prevent violent attacks, but I think they have to run some risk of that. You cannot be an academic institution and bow to those and comply with the demands of those who threaten you for your speech. If you do that, you're undermining the very system that allows you to function as an academic institution. So I think there are serious problems here. There are problems both from the government, government-run universities, the government formulating hostile environment harassment law, both of the places of employment and in educational institutions, and there are problems with private universities that, on the one hand, are sometimes enforcing similar harassment codes, but on the other hand, are just giving in to threats in a way that is just going to increase the likelihood of such threats and such violence in the future.
All right.
On that pessimistic note, I close.
Great. Thank you very much, Professor Volokh. Well, let's go ahead and open it up to questions from our audience. We've got quite a few of you out there and about 15 minutes left. So in a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. And while we're waiting for the questions to jump on, I don't know if I guess we have a few, but I don't know. Do either of other two speakers, did you have any thoughts while the other presentations are going on of any quick points you want to make before we get to questions?
This is Nina. I think that I agree with my co-panelists And I agree with Professor Volokh's last statement about how you can't really function as an academic institution if you have these codes. And what we're seeing, you know, in the Arab world, the UN issued a report called the Arab Development Report, in fact, in about 2002, in which it found that there were more books translated into Spanish in Spain in 1 year than there were into Arabic in the entire 1,000 years. This was a report written by a group of Arab scholars, Arab Muslims and Muslim scholars. I don't know if they were all Muslim, but this is absolutely correct. This is what it devolves to. You can't do anything. The extreme example, if you carry it to its logical conclusion, is Boko Haram in Nigeria, where Western education is a sin. That's what their name means, and they blow up schools to carry that out. And what I fear is that having this culture at the university normalizes the expectation that you can't say anything or do anything that offends certain groups. Now, you can attack Catholics or Jews or other groups, single out Israel, single out, you know, Mormons, but certain groups, you cannot. The university culture it raises expectations to people, young adults, as they are forming their views about the world, that this is the way it should be.
That's an excellent point, that in addition to behavior that is rewarded is repeated, when people see behavior being rewarded, when people see the way institutions respond to such threats, they learn that it's a model. The institutions are modeling how the people ought to behave. So if you allow yourself to be silenced out of fear as an institution, your students will learn that that's the thing they should be doing already. They should be doing as well.
Great. Well, we have two questions pending, so let's try to get to both of them.
Hi, this is Joel Pollack in Santa Monica, California. Just really two questions. One is how we see speech being repressed in a non-Islamic context. I live in Santa Monica here, where the response of the city council to people being offended, for example, by messages on public buses, is not to tell people they need to grow a thicker skin or just grow up, but to tell everybody there will be henceforth no messages on public buses. Or the response to a group of atheists who are offended by a nativity display is to cancel all permanent religious displays in public spaces. So the question really is, we're asking about free speech in Islam, but isn't the decline of free speech in society more generally on non-religious topics also a bit of a problem? And, you know, not setting enough of an example for people in the context of religious speech to understand. And the other question really, I think, is for Zuri, about the Muslim world. And I don't agree with those who say we should avoid offending people religiously, but one thing I do understand is some of the sentiment of where it comes from, which is partly asking a question, well, if you do allow this freewheeling criticism of Islam, or if you expect our leaders to make those criticisms, what are you really expecting them to do? What is the outcome of that criticism? Is it going to convince Muslims that they need to change how they think about their own faith and its depiction? Or is it going to encourage racists and bigots who don't like Muslims to be more open about expressing their feelings? And I think that there's something missing there, which is the articulation of the choice that faces Muslim communities. There are successful Muslim communities in the West, but they have tended to face down the choice of tolerance and freedom of expression for others and to come to terms with it. And I think this maybe relates to my first question. Because we're not upholding that same freedom in other contexts, we're not really posing that choice as one that Muslim communities have to make. Thank you.
So let me speak to the first part, and I'm happy to defer to others on the second part. I think we need to be careful in articulating what's a speech restriction and what is the government's deciding either to speak out itself or not to speak. So, for example, I don't know the details about Santa Monica, but it's certainly possible that a bus, that a city that runs a bus system, that it gets offensive bus ads, which it has to run because of the First Amendment, if it runs other bus ads, might say, look, no political ads at all. But it seems to me that's a reasonable conclusion for the city to come to. Not the only conclusion, but a reasonable one, for two related reasons. One is it says, look, you know, people might be free to say these things, but we don't want our city funds to be the vehicle for expressing certain kinds of things. We don't want our city property to be this kind of vehicle. To be sure, we have to give access to the property on a viewpoint-neutral basis. But if that's so, we as the city would like to just sit out these kinds of political debates on our buses. And that's related to the second point, which is we're run a business in a sense, a municipal business, but still a business. We want people to be comfortable, to be happy to ride our buses. We want that both to make money and because we want people to take buses rather than cars to reduce traffic and reduce pollution. So it seems to me quite reasonable for a city to say, look, we're not going to ban this kind of speech. We're not going to treat it unequally, but we are going to say we're just even-handedly not going to have political messages on our buses, whether they're about Islam or anything else. As to the religious symbols in public places, that's complicated, of course, by the Establishment Clause. There's a debate as to what the Establishment Clause means, but the court, by a narrow margin, decided that it means that the government cannot engage in speech that endorses religion or that disapproves of religion. That, it seems to me, again, you can dispute whether that's right or wrong, but that is not a constraint on what people may or may not say. It simply says that the government is not allowed to take sides in religious battles. That leaves our speech quite free. A government-imposed, here the Constitution-imposed restriction on the government itself, I think, is generally speaking not a speech abridgment, especially when it's a judgment that the government should just stay out of certain debates. And then, the one last thing, sometimes the government does get involved in debates, for example, by condemning certain kinds of speakers. And I think if that's the government's choice, that too is an acceptable choice. That while the government could say we want to stay out of certain debates, it also is entitled to, if it wants to say, we are going to get to speak out about certain political issues. In fact, it is often said that the fitting remedy for bad speech is good speech, and that may include good speech, at least in the government's view, from government actors, whether it's a city or a university chancellor. So I think it's really important to focus on a protection of people's speech against government abridgment. And when it comes to the government simply saying, we don't want to get involved in these debates, that's often a sensible position for the government to take.
This is Zudi, if I can add a few things.
Absolutely.
You know, I think the question about Islam and you have to thread the needle, obviously, and by demonizing all of Islam, you're actually going to end up, as we all know, you end up alienating the very people that we need to rally to reform the concepts that need reform. But the issue is that right now the status is when you have the government calling it violent extremism and not even identifying it as political Islam or Islamism and theocracy as the problem, you end up, by virtue of that veto, allowing the domination of the entire power structure of the OIC, dictators, theocrats, and you marginalize reformers. We ran an ad in the New York Times January 11th, signed by 24 different Muslim organizations, many of whom were women's groups, that said, you know, here we are, we exist, use us, let us have a seat at the table. But by the government staying out of it, it actually is endorsing one form of Islam, which is Islamism. And then the left, for example, Center for American Progress puts out this report called Fear Inc., in which they say that there's this whole industry of anti-Islam out there, and it includes me in that, which is absurd. For somebody who is orthodox in my practice, who loves my faith, to be called an Islamophobe is a form of a non-Muslim group trying to tell me what is and what is not Islam. And I do think there is, and I cannot overstate this, there is a unique responsibility that American Muslims have in this global battle, because we have the ability in our society to understand that you can merge secular society with the ability to protect your individuality and your free practice of faith. Europe has a much bigger problem with radical Islam because it's concepts of freedom are often based in a very anti-religious, laïcité type mentality, as you see in France and elsewhere, versus in America, our first freedom is religious freedom, and that Muslims in America, I think, if we operationalize the ability to promote free speech and discourse and criticism as being part of modernization, then ultimately that can be the solution to the theocratic control of our communities right now. And it's a pathological amount of tribalism and obstruction. And right now, most organizations will not debate us because they know that if we had a Lincoln Douglas debate with leading imams at the Islamic Society of North America or other Muslim Brotherhood legacy groups, they would lose, and ultimately the emperor would have no clothes as far as who's leading the Muslim community. But right now, there is no one who's taking sides, and I think that Establishment Clause concept is the solution that I think we could translate into Arabic, as Nina was mentioning and you were, that if you start teaching them the ideas that have already been discovered in the West, that you can have a very Islamic, President Waheed said, you could have a state of Islam in your heart, but you don't need an Islamic state to do that.
Well, this is Christian Corrigan. We're running towards the end of the hour. I just want to check how many of our speakers could stick around for an extra 5 minutes or so. It's obviously okay if you can't. Can anyone stick around for a couple extra minutes?
Sure.
Okay, great. We've got one more pending question, so let's try to get to that and see where we get to with that question.
Yeah, this is Robert Muse. I'm with the American Freedom Law Center, and really, I have a couple of comments that I wouldn't mind perhaps some reaction. And we actually are representing those plaintiffs in the Philadelphia bus case that Nina had mentioned at the beginning of her comments. But last week on March 4th, I argued a case before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, an en banc. It was a 15-judge panel. That is the quintessential heckler's veto case, I think goes right to the heart of this issue. I represent a group of Christian evangelists who were literally assaulted by a violent mob at an Arab festival, a violent mob of Muslims who were armed with bottles and rocks and other debris. And the Wayne County Sheriff's Department gave the Christians an ultimatum. They could either leave the Arab festival or they'd be arrested for disorderly conduct. And we sued the Wayne County Sheriff's Department, certainly a heckler's veto. And our district court judge held that the violence justified the actions of the police, even if they were responding to the effect of the speech on the listener. And we appealed to the Sixth Circuit, and the three-judge panel ruled against us 2-1. And the dissenting judge, I think, made the right point. He said not only was that decision wrong, it was dangerously wrong. And he made the point that essentially you have the government enforcing blasphemy laws. And so then we promptly filed a petition for a hearing en banc, and it was granted. And that was just argued last last week. But so this is, the heckler's veto is alive and well. I mean, this was in 2012, and the video of this, you can go online and see it virtually anywhere, Bible Believers, Arab Festival, at 2 million plus views, that it's shocking that happens on our city streets. But to me, even more shocking, you have a district court judge and at least two judges on a three-judge panel, and hopefully the en banc court will remedy that problem. But if they don't, and I know Professor Volokh has some familiarity with this case, and I fully agree. If you have behavior that gets rewarded, gets repeated. And, I think this is a big problem. But one other, and just another quick comment, we're representing a group of citizens here in Michigan who were opposing the rezoning of their neighborhood to build a large Islamic center. And they complained about traffic congestion and so forth. Spoke out at the public hearings, and for their exercising of their First Amendment right, they were issued some very harassing subpoenas by the Council on American Islamic Relations, who were representing the proponents of the mosque. And thankfully, we filed a motion to quash, and the judge granted the motion, issued a protective order, and awarded us attorney's fees. But there's other ways in which speech can be suppressed in this battle. But anyways, I just wanted to make those comments, and if anyone has any comments on those, I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thanks very much for mentioning the Bible Believers case. I'm sorry, I had actually been meaning to mention it myself under the fear category, and I just forgot. I had indeed blogged about it when it came down, and I was very when the panel decision came down, and I was very happy to see the Sixth Circuit taking the case en banc, so agreeing to hear it, the entire court. One interesting thing to note, and I think it is, it's just good to remind ourselves of this. The panel decision was 2-1, and the majority was a Democratic appointee and a Republican appointee. They're the ones who said, yes, this speech could be suppressed because of a danger of violence. Essentially, yes, the government can enforce a heckler's veto. And the dissenting judge was Judge Clay, who was a Democratic appointee. So I think a lot of people take the view of, oh, this is conservatives who are in favor of protecting this kind of speech and liberals who are in favor of suppressing it. I think there are some liberals who are willing to suppress it and some liberals who are willing to protect it. There are some conservatives who are willing to protect it and some conservatives, especially kind of not quite law and order, but civic peace conservatives who say, hey, you know, why do we want this hassle? Why do we want the risk of violence? Let's just suppress the speech before people get too upset. So one thing to keep in mind is this isn't really a left-right issue as such. It's some on the left and some on the right against others on the left and others on the right.
Yeah, I would second that as well. I remember Republican Senator Lindsey Graham came out with the idea that we should ban the burning of Korans after that Florida pastor was threatening to burn a Koran. And that was at the time when the administration was leaning on him very heavily with phone calls from all sorts of cabinet members and generals to telling him, don't burn the Koran. It created an international spectacle just to have that happen. But anyhow, Lindsey Graham had this idea. It didn't go anywhere, but he did defend it in National Review online. And, you know, a couple years later, you come up to the Charlie Hebdo cartoon incident. It wouldn't have helped, you know, wouldn't have helped us if those cartoons had been created that reaction here, because that would have only pertained to the Koran, not to the protection of the Prophet's reputation. So that's how you go down this path, and it gets broader and broader and broader. And in fact, I want to pick up on something that quickly just mentioned that validate what Zudi said, Zudi Jasser, about, you know, America, it really is an American issue because the rest of the world already has these restrictions, including Western Europe, including the UK, Canada, and the other Anglo countries like Anglo law-based countries in Australia. They have hate speech laws that are used as proxies for Islamic blasphemy.
Dr. Jasser, any thoughts?
Yeah, I could not agree more. I think that ultimately, the issue is actually as difficult as this issue is, you know, there are, I could not agree more that there are many Muslims, if not the majority, that are well adjusted to American society and free speech. But the issue has to do with when you did a poll, they did a poll of American Muslims that said that 58 or 60% said that there should be some restrictions on criticism of Islam. Now they would respond and tell you that, well, they also want that on Christianity and Judaism to protect the people of the book and other believers in the God of Abraham. But the bottom line is that I think we sometimes overestimate the uniqueness of the American experiment and what Jefferson, Thomas Paine, and others did in the rejection of theocracy, and we assume that our immigrant population somehow absorbed that. And I think there's a lot of work to be done domestically and abroad. Organizations that claim to speak for the Muslim community often just don't get what the Establishment Clause is and why that not only is important for the United States, but how that can be operationalized internally within Muslim communities in America and also abroad. I mean, we changed, the Arab Awakening transformed Muslim communities, huge countries from Tunisia and Libya and Syria and others that were an opportunity, that now that opportunity is being missed because we have been missing in action. And they used Western technologies, be it Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook, to start that metamorphosis, but ultimately now it's been quashed. And I think if we operationalize free speech to every Muslim that I've had, we have a Muslim Liberty Project that teaches Muslims about the need for American-type systems abroad to be the best type of system. And it takes a while, but once they're convinced of it, A, it prevents them from ever being radicalized because they don't look at the West as a demon and they look at it as very integral to their faith. But second, it is the only strategy. There's no military solution to the global threat of radical Islam.
Well, I want to thank, on behalf of the Federal Society, all three of our experts for joining us today for a really very, very, very good discussion of this topic, and we hope to be doing more programming on this in the future. On behalf of the Federal Society, I also want to thank our audience. Thank you for calling in. A reminder that you can find the podcast of this call on our website, posted in the next few days, so you can re-listen to it or stream it, download or stream it again on your computer or mobile device. And a reminder to check our website for the list of all the upcoming Teleform conference calls, as well as the recordings of all of our previous ones. So until next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much for calling in today.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.